Richard, how you doing?
I'm good.
How are things up in Toronto?
Sunny, humid, but it tastes like freedom, to be very honest.
It tastes like freedom. Hard Knocks. I'm a huge fan on this show. No, I don't. Look, I don't. I come right out and just say it. I look forward to it every year. I don't care who the subject is. It looks like the Browns have captured some folks' attention. Got pretty good ratings on it. Are you a Hard Knocks guy? I know you've put some stuff out there on The Athletic about it.
Yeah, you know, I didn't actually watch the second episode. I did watch the first one. But I am a Hard Knocks fan because I have really immense respect for NFL Films and the crew that works Hard Knocks every year. A couple years ago, for when I was at Sports Illustrated, I went to Cincinnati and watched them for a couple of days filming Hard Knocks, and you really just come away with just how unbelievably talented the camera people are, the operators are, the editors are. So, I mean, it's really superb, high-quality filmmaking. And this year, I have to give the Browns a lot of credit. You know, the way it works is that the teams see a cut before it ever gets to us, and they have certainly the right of refusal to take anything out that they think would be, you know, would give other teams a competitive advantage, stuff that they don't want in. But, historically, they've been pretty good about letting some stuff in that you might not think would get in. And I have to give the Browns credit. The Todd Haley stuff from the first episode, where he's really questioning Hugh Jackson, kind of questioning the entire culture of the Browns, really. I was impressed that they left that in, because that, you know, that Hugh Jackson was really criticized for that after the fact. I read a lot of columns basically calling him out for that, and I thought that was pretty ballsy of him to let that in, probably knowing, well, if he didn't know he was going to be criticized, that's one thing, but if he did know, totally bullying on him, because it gave you real interesting insight into what those coaches' meetings are like and how there's different philosophies. And then, you know, there's always every year going to be people who stand out, who sort of become stars of their own right. I think some of that is real. I think some of that is honestly a little acting for the cameras. You know, Rex Ryan famously when Hard Knocks with the Jets. And, you know, I think Jarvis Landry absolutely is a really interesting big personality. But, again, you always wonder, you know, if they're amping it up a little bit for the cameras. But overall, I think it's a great production, and it's definitely one of the best sports documentary series that we've ever had.
Yeah, any young player should watch episode 2 and know what not to do, what not to say to your head coach, because it may get you traded. Like, say to him, well, if you don't want me, trade me, like Coleman did. You'll find that out in episode 2.
Yeah.
You know, barging into Hugh Jackson's office. Yeah, if you don't want me, just trade me. Okay, we will.
Yeah, and again, that's interesting that they left that in. First episode, by the way, did really well. 7.5 million viewers was, I think, the second most watched first episode since 2015. Maybe the second most watched episode since 2010. Maybe I'm right about that. And then last night's, whenever it was, Tuesday's episode dropped a little bit to 5 million. But that's not so unexpected, because usually the debut episode is always much higher. But I think Hard Knocks has a good story. You know, they're counterintuitively, you might think an 0-16 team is not interesting, but I think actually they're really, really interesting, and more interesting than like a 7-9 team.
It doesn't seem like ESPN right now is ready to completely move away from Chris Berman. It seems like they're in talks of maybe trying to woo him back.
Yeah, I heard this too. I heard this like a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't nail it down, so I didn't want to publish anything, even on spec. So credit Andrew Marchand of the New York Post for getting it out there and feeling like he's got enough to publish. I definitely think it's true. I just heard this a couple weeks ago that Norby Williamson is an executive there who's now in charge of SportsCenter, and he has a long relationship with Chris Berman. He was Chris Berman's PA way back in the day, like 30-something years ago. So he's got a long-term relationship with him. He's also an executive who's tried to retool SportsCenter kind of back to the 90s and 2000s, where it's just very highlight-driven. Whether that turns out to be a good strategy or not, we'll see. So, yeah, I think probably there's something to that. Wouldn't be surprised if you see Berman have some kind of Sunday night after the games role on SportsCenter where, you know, I don't know, maybe they give him some 10, 20-minute segment, 15-minute segment where he does the highlights of all the games. I don't expect him to be back on Sunday NFL Countdown. I think that has passed. You're not going to see him hosting with Randy Moss, Woodson, or whoever's there. But I would not be surprised at all if he has some kind of extended Sports Center segment during the NFL season.
We're talking to Richard Deitz, the media circus, now with The Athletic. And, Richard, you wrote a good piece. And it's funny, we were talking about this very thing on Monday. We had a guest on, Taylor Zarzo, who was hosting the Sirius satellite radio coverage, about the dynamic of when Tiger is really doing well, but you have a tremendous story in Brooks Koepka winning the tournament and trying to meld those and balance those two things together as they're happening. But put it all together, CBS certainly hit a home run with the ratings.
Yeah, I mean, Tiger is the one who drives the ratings. There's no Brooks Koepka. But, you know, no one is tuning in who has not watched golf before to watch Brooks Koepka win a major. It's all related to Tiger. And those ratings were up 70%, which is, I mean, almost unheard of in sports television viewership. They drew basically 9 million viewers for the final round of the PGA Championship, which is a pretty incredible number. And, I talked to CBS's lead golf producer, a guy named Lance Barrow, who's basically been doing that for 20-something years. And it's a tricky navigation. You know that Tiger's a big story. You know that people want to watch Tiger. At the same time, these guys cover the golf tour every week. So they have to, they can't abandon in full, the Adam Scotts of the world, the Brooks Koepkas. So I went back and looked. I thought they did a pretty good job of really focusing on Tiger, especially at 18, and then still giving us Adam Scott and Brooks Koepka live at 17 and staying in that tournament. But, in my opinion, the people who complain to CBS about too much Tiger, CBS cannot. I mean, not that you can't take that seriously, but you honestly have to just sort of like read it and then just move on, because the reality is Tiger Woods is one of the most fascinating athletes of the last 20 years. The singular and sole reason you just doubled your audience basically is because of him. So to me, you can't overcover him enough. So, yeah, I get it. There's some diehards who are like, why do you keep showing Tiger? Why do you do this? Well, you're showing Tiger Woods because he's one of the great athletes of the 21st century, and he had like one of the biggest self-inflicted meltdowns we've ever seen of an athlete of that greatness. And so his story is compelling. And again, I don't feel sorry for Tiger. Most of that's self-inflicted. But it's a fascinating story. It's a total narrative that I think all of us are interested in. So I thought CBS did an excellent job at the PGA, but on the larger scale, honestly, I don't think you can cover Tiger enough at this point in his career, given we're only 2 years removed from people thinking he would never be playing again.
Richard, we have another example of the investigative journalism leading to action on a story in the case of the Maryland situation. Your thoughts on the piece that ESPN did, and maybe how it's contributed to the reaction of Maryland?
To be honest with you, I don't think anything is happening in Maryland without that piece. You could draw the direct line from that piece that ESPN published to President Wallace Lowe, AD Damon Evans, basically calling that news conference and letting you know they went down to talk to that the deceased player's parents and apologizing and accepting, whatever that means, moral and actual responsibility. None of that happens, in my opinion, without ESPN's piece. They had to react. That's what happens when a national place publishes that. Alums read it. They get pissed off, and they start sending letters or emails to the university. The big question is whether, you were impressed by the president being transparent or more transparent than other presidents and getting out there, or, and this is fair too, and this is what I heard from a lot of Maryland types, you're angry still at the fact that it took him, the ESPN piece, to react and to sort of move because the press ultimately held them accountable. But, yeah, I don't think anything happens at Maryland, at least not in this time frame, without that ESPN piece.
I find it interesting, too, that the athletic trainer, that looked like it was pretty clear-cut, the documentation of how they actually treated the athlete when he was under duress. I think what would be more interesting, and maybe where the article shed light where they probably were not willing to go, is how the culture might have fit into how they ended up treating the athlete? That's the more difficult question to ask, I think.
Yeah, great question and a big legal question. I mean, again, if you take the article at face, and it doesn't seem to me that a lot of people have challenged much of the reporting on the toxic environment at Maryland, it would lead one to believe that the culture there was like, you know, the old Junction Boys, basically, like, you know, putting these guys out there, getting them to practice until, you know, they're basically exhausted or throwing up. You know, it's, I have to be honest with you, I know I'm saying this on a, you know, Nashville, Tennessee radio station where college football is king, but the whole thing just is like, college football, for all its greatness, has so much cesspool stuff and so much BS, like, tied into it about, like, manhood and testosterone, and it's, you know, and honestly, it's coaches with power run amok, and in this case, what it looks like or what it appears to be is a program pushing this nonsense to the point where a kid died. Like, you just, whatever safeguards you had in place, it just totally were not there in lieu of, you know, trying to get these guys to sort of go to what looked like unhealthy places. So I think it's very clear that Maryland's going to be paying a ton of money to the parents of that kid. Not that it makes up at all for the death of the kid. And I would be stunned if DJ Durkin is coaching at Maryland ever again. And then the question is going to be, should the AD be there? To me, you know, if it falls under your watch, you're responsible. And then, you know, it gets to the larger question of what are the president's responsibility. But, and you guys know this, you know, in the end, there's no satisfaction even if those people resign or are fired. Like, is there any satisfaction from anybody at Michigan State, you know, maybe outside of Larry Nassar going to prison, like, losing their job? None. Like, the abuse happened or the death happened. And so it's, we're seeing too many of these stories in college football, and I'm not saying Urban Meyer is a parallel exactly to this, but, you know, from Art Briles to everything else, it's money has just so corrupted this system that I think you're going to see more of this stuff than less, because there's so much money for these universities to make through their athletic departments, that they're going to bring guys in who, you know, will be bullies and will do anything basically to get wins. The irony, of course, is that Maryland wasn't even a very good football team.
Yeah. Well said. Here to report that tomorrow, I believe, is when it'll be made official. The Athletic will be in Nashville, but we're gonna hold off. We know who's in. Who's involved? There'll be some
the pieces are in place.
The pieces are in place, and I think the announcement is going to get made tomorrow. So Athletic will be.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I made a pledge to my bosses that I would, you know, I'm not reporting on the Athletic in the same way I don't report on Sports Illustrated. I could be criticized for them. That's fine. I have to accept that criticism. But I will say this: perhaps you guys have excellent sourcing. Would be what I might say on that.
Well, we're not going to – I know Will Muschamp says we're gutless, but we're going to leave our sources anonymous, okay? Will,
right,
Muschamp, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and by the way, how good did Will look over the next couple of days?
You mean the back pedal? He was – I timed his back pedal. It was pretty fast. He could probably still play football.
Usain Bolt-esque. But, like, that to me is part and parcel of the tribalism – the worst of the tribalism of college football, where this guy's first instinct is to sort of go off on the press, protect DJ Durkin, and to criticize anonymous sources. Now, whether Will knew this or not, knowing full well how hard is it to go against a football program, like, by putting your name on it? There's a reason why you have to give people anonymity and protection, because look what's happened to Courtney Smith at Ohio State. You know, and
yes.
Again, that's not a perfect. I'm not saying like everything she has said is 100% accurate, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, when you put your name out there like that, you get death threats, you get abuse, you get social media destruction. So this is why anonymity has to be given sometimes to protect sources, particularly people who are still on the staffs of these colleges where they're still getting paid and their livelihoods exist. And Will Muschamp knows all that, but yet went de facto into protect my coaching buddy at all costs. And it's just a larger problem. And then and again, not surprising but frustrating, you have people in that community then yelling at press for asking the question as opposed to being upset by Will Muschamp's defend DJ Durkin at all cost stance, which is it's just frustrating.
Yeah, I'm not going to go on that rant again. I've already done it this week. Richard, always a pleasure. Thanks for doing this. Have a great weekend, and we'll do it again next week.
You got it. See you guys.